Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is the 19th of December 2013 here in Japan, and today we are honored to be joined on the line once again by G. Edward Griffin, a man who should need very little introduction to my regular listeners, I imagine. But for those who do need some introduction, of course, G. Edward Griffin has been a guest on the program a couple of times so far in the past, and his websites are RealityZone.com and FreedomForceInternational.org, where you can find more about the work that he's doing, and of course, links to his many books on many different subjects, but of course this is the 19th of December, which means that we are approaching the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve Act, the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. And on that note, of course, we're going to be talking about the seminal work on the subject, The Creature from Jekyll Island, by Mr. Griffin. I will not do a disservice to the other researchers who have written about this by calling it the book on the Federal Reserve, but it is certainly one of the most important and influential books on this subject, and one that is oft-cited. So if you are interested in the Federal Reserve and how it functions and why it functions and what it is designed to do and where it is going, and have not read this book, then you are doing yourself a disservice. So I would first of all exhort you to read this book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and second of all, please join us for this conversation. G. Edward Griffin, it is a pleasure and an honor to have you here. Thank you again for your time.
Well, thanks for inviting me, James. It's a pleasure.
Excellent. Well, as I say, we are here in late December 2013 on the verge of the 100th anniversary of the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. And this is a topic that is so mind-bogglingly large that it's difficult to find a way to get a handle on the situation. Although in your book, you frame it as a type of mystery, a whodunit, as a way of trying to put a frame around the conversation. So in that regard, perhaps we can start by reflecting on the 100th anniversary of the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, to cast our minds back to that time in December 1913, at the time that this act was being passed in the House and then in the Senate on the 22nd and 23rd of December. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about the passage of the act itself and some of the unusual circumstances surrounding that passage.
Well, yes, the actual passage of the act, James, as you well know, was kind of a non-event. It happened at the end of the political season. A lot of the congressmen and senators had gone home for Christmas, and it's even questionable that they had a quorum. But in any event, there wasn't much attention given to the actual passage of the act, and I think it was scheduled for that part of the season primarily to give it an invisibility and to short-circuit any possibility of debate on the issue. And some people, some researchers have assumed that it was part of a sneaky strategy to get the passage through without facing the full wrath and a questioning of the Congress at large. I don't quite see it that way. I know there was plenty of sneakiness going on. I see it as a means of avoiding debate and getting on with it. But as I looked at the political situation at that time, it was pretty clear that Congress was on board. Had there been debate, had there been serious questions, it still would have passed. So I don't think it was a means of getting it passed, but it was a means of just getting it passed quickly and avoiding a lot of embarrassing questions. But it brings up a deeper question, and that is that why would they even worry about it in the first place? Why would they want to do it quickly? And the reality is, of course, that there was a lot of deceit going on. The Federal Reserve Act was being sold to the American people, and to a large extent to members of Congress as well, who were kind of slow in the saddle picking up on what was really going on. It was being sold as a means of controlling the banks, because there was a lot of concern at that time among the American people and in Congress that the banks were out of control, and the people wanted legislation to control the money trust, which is what they called it in those days. And so the legislation was supposed to put the brakes on the money trust and put regulations in place to make sure that the banking industry didn't take advantage of the people and didn't dominate the nation and so forth. And so what actually happened, when you go back and carefully read the history leading up to the passage of the act, which was actually almost a non-event because the real action had happened 3 years prior to that. It all started in 1910, so there was a three-year playing field there, a time window to make all this happen. What happened is that the banks decided that since there was going to be legislation anyway to control their industry, that they wouldn't just sit back and wait and see what happened and cross their fingers that it would be okay. They decided that to do what so many cartels do today, they decided to take the lead, and they would be the ones calling for regulations and reform. They like the word reform, and the American people are suckers for the word reform. You just put that into any corrupt piece of legislation, call it reform, and people say, oh, I'm all for reform, and so they vote for it or accept it. So that's what they were doing. They decided we will reform our own industry. In other words, we will create a cartel, and we will give the cartel the power of government. We'll take our cartel agreement so that we can self-regulate to our advantage, and we'll call it the Federal Reserve Act. And then we'll take this cartel agreement to Washington and convince those idiots there to pass it into law. And that basically was the strategy. It was a brilliant strategy. Of course, we see it happening all the time, and certainly in our own day today, we see the same thing happening in other cartelized industry. Right now, we're watching it unfold in the field of healthcare, but at that time, it was banking, all right? And so the banking cartel wrote their own rules and regulations, called it the Federal Reserve Act, got it passed into law, and it was very much to their liking because they wrote it. And in essence, what they had created is a set of rules which made it possible for themselves to regulate their industry, but they went even beyond that. In fact, it's clear to me when I was reading their letters and their conversations at the time and the debates that they never dreamed that Congress would go along and also give them the right to issue the nation's money supply. I mean, not only were they now going to regulate their own industry, which is what they started out as wanting to do, but they got this incredible gift that they didn't dream would be given to them, although they were negotiating for it. And that was Congress gave them the authority to issue the nation's money. And Congress gave away the sovereign right to issue the nation's money to the private banks. And so all of this was in the Federal Reserve Act. And the American people were joyous because they were told and they were convinced that this was finally a means of controlling this big creature from Jekyll Island. And so that, in a nutshell, James, as you know, is really the mystery. That is the whodunit. That is the crime, not of the century, but the millennium. It's the greatest legalized plunder, I think, the world has ever seen. And that's what I wrote about.
And unfortunately, it still continues to this day, so that's why it is so important to spread the awareness of this. And as you mentioned in your book, you have solved the crime. We know who did it, and it can be laid out. But unfortunately, very few still have heard about this. So why don't we examine this in a little bit greater detail? Of course, you mentioned the context that led up to the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. Why don't we go back to 1907 to take a look at the banking panic that was happening at that time that started the process that became eventually the Federal Reserve Act?
Yes, it's hard to pick a starting point, isn't it? You could go back a century or so beyond that, and the whole process starts, the process of decay and corruption starts with something called fractional reserve banking. That's the technical name for it. And what that really means is that as the banking institution developed over several centuries, starting, of course, in Europe, It developed the practice of legalizing a certain dishonest accounting procedure. In other words, in the very, very beginning, if you want to go all the way back, people would bring their gold or silver to the banks for safekeeping. And they'd say, give us a paper receipt. And we don't want to guard our silver and our gold because, you know, people could come in the middle of the night and they could kill us or tie us up and and threaten us, and they'll get our gold and silver, so we can't really guard it. We'll take it to the bank and have them guard it, and we just want a paper receipt so that we can take the receipt back and get our gold anytime we want. And so in the beginning, you know, money was receipt money. They could then, instead of changing or exchanging the gold coins, they could exchange the receipts, and people would expect accept the receipts just as well as the gold, knowing they could get the gold. And so these paper receipts being circulated were, in essence, the very first examples of paper money. Well, the banks learned early on that game that here they were sitting on this pile of gold and all these paper receipts out there. People weren't bringing the receipts in anymore. Very few of them, maybe 5%, maybe 7% of the people would bring in their paper receipts and ask for the gold. So they said, why don't we just sort of give more receipts out than we have gold? They'll never know we only are asked at the best 7% of it, so we can create more receipts for gold than we have, and we can collect interest on that because we'll loan that into the economy, and we'll charge interest on this money that we don't really have. And it's a pretty good gimmick, don't you think? And they, well, yeah, of course. And so that's how fractional reserve banking started. And now it's institutionalized, and they teach it in school. No one ever questions the integrity of it or the ethics of it. They say, well, that's the way banking works. And isn't it wonderful that we now have this flexible currency and we have prosperity and all of this sort of thing? So it all starts with this concept of fractional reserve banking. The trouble is with that is it works most of the time, but every once in a while, there are a few ripples that come along that are a little bit bigger than the other ripples, and maybe one of them is a wave, and more than 7% will come in and ask for their gold. Maybe 20% will come in, or 30%, and well, now the banks are embarrassed because the fraud is exposed. They said, well, we don't have your gold. What do you mean you don't have my gold? I gave it to you and put it on deposit, and you said you'd safeguard it. Well, we don't have it. We loaned it out. So then the word gets out, and everybody and their uncle comes and lines up for their gold. And of course, they don't have it, and the banks are closed. They have bank holidays, and the banks are embarrassed. They go out of business. People lose their savings, and you have these terrible banking crashes that were ricocheting all around the world prior to this time. And that's what caused the concern. One of the things that caused the concern of the American people, they didn't want that anymore. They wanted to put a stop to that. And that was the whole purpose, supposedly, of the Federal Reserve System, is to put a stop to that. But since the people who designed the plan to put a stop to it were the very ones who were doing it in the first place, you can not be surprised that their solution was not a very good one insofar as the American people were concerned. Their solution was to expand it, not to control it, but to expand it. See, prior to that time, this little game of fractional reserve banking was localized at the state level. Each state was doing its own little fractional reserve banking system. Each state, in essence, had its own Federal Reserve. Central banks were authorized by state law to do this sort of thing, and that was causing all this problem. And so the Federal Reserve came along and said, well, no, we're not going to do this at the state level anymore because look at all the problem it's causing. We're going to consolidate it all together, and we're going to do it at the national level. And because we're going to make it bigger, we'll be able to control it, they said. So in essence, that's what happened. Instead of solving the problem, the expression they use today is they kicked the can down a little bit and they made the problem bigger. And now here we are and at the 100th anniversary, and we're looking at almost the place where the can cannot be kicked any further. The can has been kicked so many times that it's not even a can anymore, little pieces of tin, and there's not much to kick anymore.
Well, I think something that you've mentioned a couple of times now is the duplicity with which this was brought about. And part of that duplicity is even encoded in the name itself, the Federal Reserve, which I hope by now many people have heard the refrain that the Federal Reserve is neither federal nor a reserve. But let's examine that a little bit more, because as you point out in your book, it's also not even a bank. It's referred to as the Federal Reserve System. But what is this system, and how does it function to create the majority of the money supply?
Well, the system really is a cartel. And that was, to me, the most shocking discovery early on when I was starting my research on this. Because like most people. I came through school. I got pretty good grades on a few topics, and that was one of them. And I came through school, had all the correct answers. I knew what the Federal Reserve System was. It was a central bank. I wasn't quite sure what that was, but I got a correct answer on my test and so forth. I always thought it was the government agency, but now I found out, no, just the opposite. It was a bunch of private banks, the strongest, biggest banks in America, with deep roots in the biggest banks in Europe. I mean, these original founders of the Federal Reserve were partners, very close partners with the Rothschilds in Europe and the Warburgs and all the big banking dynasties of Europe. There was a lot of money and advice and control that came from Europe too, but it's primarily an American institution. And so they came together and they formed a cartel. They decided, all right, we're not going to compete anymore. It used to be maybe 10, 15 years prior to that, that there was a lot of competition between these big investment houses as they struggled for dominance in the investment capitals of the world, in Paris and London, New York, and a lot of competition. Well, now it came time. This was the turn of the last century, a time when industry all around the world, and in the United States in particular, was becoming monopolized and centralized and controlled, cartelized. The old idea of free enterprise competition had fallen into disfavor. And people like John D. Rockefeller had said, and his biographers all quote him on this, he said, competition is a sin. Well, of course, it's a sin because he didn't want anybody to compete with him now that he was at the top of the heap, and that's how it works. So they were working now to figure out ways to avoid competition. And once you're, you know, if you've got the world in the grasp of two or three large corporations, that's good enough. You don't need it to be one. You can get together with the other two corporations and say, well, all right, we'll just share this. And we're not going to fight among each other anymore. But we'll come to an agreement with each other. We'll divvy up the markets. We won't compete on profits or geography or products or services. We'll agree to share. And basically, that was happening across the board at all aspects of commerce and industry, and it was happening in banking. So basically, to cut all of this short, is what happened precisely at the time of the creation of the Federal Reserve is that this banking industry in America decided to avoid competition, really strict competition, and form a cooperation or a union. A cartel is the proper word for it. And so that's really my discovery of the fact that this system was really nothing more than a private banking cartel that had gotten its cartel agreement passed into law, so that now this agreement had the effect of law, and if you didn't go along with it, you're going to go to prison. And that's the thing that makes it look like government, because government gave this private group the power of imprisonment, of the law behind it. And that's what makes it so deceptive. So to answer your question, the short term is this system really is nothing but a banking cartel, and it has grown. You can imagine the old saying, everybody knows it, he who has the gold makes the rules. That's the golden rule. Well, think about not just having the gold or having the money, but creating the money, the power to create the money, literally out of nothing. This is absolute unlimited power in the hands of a banking cartel. And it didn't take long before that power allowed this group to flip over. Instead of being subservient to government, it now was dominant over government. And we have a situation today where this financial group, this elite, is really running the show. It is the government of the world, literally, not just the United States, but of the world. And the people of the world have not yet picked up to that fact.
Another part of this deception is the fact that the history of the central banking idea in the United States in particular, and of course in the world in general, has been excised from our education so that we can correctly answer that the Federal Reserve is a central bank without even knowing what a central bank really is, or the fact that there have been several central banks in America's history before this point, all of which failed for various reasons. Although, again, we don't learn very much about that in our history classes these days. Perhaps you can tell us about the history of central banking in the United States.
Well, it's a long and interesting history, but I think the important points can be summarized very quickly. And you've already mentioned it, that the Federal Reserve is not the first example. Actually, it's the third example in our history. There was one in place when the country was formed. Incredible as it may seem, it was a central bank. It didn't last very long. It eventually became, I think, Bank of Philadelphia. But it was a central bank, and it didn't last long because, of course, it issued money based on a credit, and it was a means of creating money out of nothing that the government could spend, and it did, and it resulted in inflation, and there were runs on the bank, in fact, fractional reserve banking, the whole thing, and it didn't take long, just a few years before it was phased out. Well, another one came along. The Bank of North America was the first one, and then the first bank of the United States, the Central Bank of the United States, and that was the one that everybody knows about. The Jackson, President Jackson went after Andrew Jackson. He was a feisty guy, and he called these bankers, said, "You're a den of vipers, and I will cast thee out." You know, he was that kind of fiery oratory, and he meant it too. He put his political career on the line. And he almost was impeached because of it. It was almost a fluke of history that the fact that the central bank, this former Federal Reserve System, not called that, was deliberately causing economic havoc in the United States, deliberately tightening the money supply and then loosening it and tightening it to cause these ricochets and these boom and bust cycles. And they were calling in loans, and they wanted to blame Jackson for that. They said, "You see, you're messing around with this delicate banking system, this wonderful banking system. You see what President Jackson has done to us?" And that it leaked out that actually was being done by the bank itself. And once that got into the newspapers, of course, the tide of public opinion turned very quickly against the bank. The guy's name was Biddle, who headed the bank. It'd be like our chairman of the Federal Reserve System. And he wound up in terrible disgrace, and the bank was finally phased out. So that was the second time we got rid of a central bank. And that lasted for a couple of decades. And then finally, the Federal Reserve comes in, and now here we are the third time along. And it's the same old game. And we're just waiting for someone like Andrew Jackson, I suppose, to come along and lead the charge. I was hoping it might have been Congressman Ron Paul, but maybe it'll be his son. If it's not, it's got to be somebody. Maybe it'll be you, James. We need a good, strong, fiery leader to say, "You are a den of vipers, and I will cast thee out." It's time to repeat that little piece of history.
Well, I couldn't agree more, but as a Canadian, I think I'll stick to the Bank of Canada for now. But
yeah,
but I certainly do.
Enough vipers over
the
there.
well, let's examine. We are 100 years into this Federal Reserve experiment by now, so certainly we do have some results that we can look to of what this has actually accomplished. And if the idea, at least supposedly, was to prevent bank runs and bank panics, then the Federal Reserve not only failed signally, it failed very quickly, as, of course, just a decade and a half after the creation of the Federal Reserve itself, America was plunged into the Great Depression and one of the greatest times of poverty in the history of the country. Let's talk a little bit about the Great Depression and the Federal Reserve's role in it.
Yes, but first I'd like to make a quick comment on the assumption that if the goal of the Federal Reserve is to prevent bank panics and to stabilize the economy, it hasn't done a very good job. That's true, but the active word there is if. If that is the goal of the Federal Reserve, and it isn't. You see, what is the goal of any cartel? It's not to prevent bank panics. It's to preserve the interests of the members of the cartel. So if you can't stop a bank panic, at least you can bail out the banks. At least you can protect the banks from it. And you can pass laws to make them not liable and so forth, get them off, get out of jail free card, so to speak. So people say, yeah, the Federal Reserve hasn't done a very good job, has it? And my answer is, done an excellent job if you understand what its job really is. But you're going on the basis that its job was to protect the American people, and its job is to protect the banks. And if you understand what its job really was, and now you look at its report card, you say, well, it gets an A, because the banks have done very well throughout any crisis ever since the Federal Reserve was conceived. So now, getting to the next part of your question, which, if you refresh my memory again,
The Great Depression. And
the Great Depression, yes, thank you. Well, yes, that brings up, I guess the place to start is what caused the Depression. And I think most economists would agree, regardless of what they think about the Federal Reserve, they would agree that it was the boom-bust cycle, that it was the expansion of credit, the expansion of the money supply, and then the rapid contraction of it and the ricocheting effect and all of that sort of thing. What they disagree on is what caused the boom-bust cycle. Some people think it was the result of unbridled capitalism. It's the socialists and the collectivists all think that freedom, especially free market, is the cause of these terrible things. I see it quite differently, because every time you see a boom-bust cycle, not only in the United States, but anywhere in the world throughout history, if you look at the background economy, you'll find that there was government intervention in the natural forces of supply and demand in the marketplace, especially in the expansion of money. In every case, it was because there was government intervention and allowed fiat money to be created on the basis of political decree and political judgment. Well, we're going to help employment, or we're going to we're going to combat inflation, or somebody's got some idea of how he's going to help people. But how are they going to help people? They're going to intervene. They're going to take charge. They're going to prevent people from acting in a manner that they might otherwise act voluntarily if they were left alone. And it was that process of intervening and manipulating the money supply and diverting credit into malinvestments and so forth for political reasons that causes the money supply to expand in the first place. And now you've got the bubble. Well, when you've created the bubble will eventually burst. Now you've got the collapse and so forth. And so we come back to what happened in the United States in the Great Depression. It was a classic case of expansion of the money supply through the Federal Reserve System. They made it happen. The next question that comes along is, well, why did they make it happen? And I think we've already covered that. It wasn't because they really thought it was good for America. They thought it was good for the banks. And that's not hard to figure out. Why would it be good for the banks? Well, how did the banks make money? They make money by collecting interest on loans. And so the more loans they can make, the more money they make. And if the money supply is limited, then they can't make many loans because they're limited by the money that's in their vault. But you give them the power to create money out of nothing and then lend it, well, then they have an infinite supply of inventory of money, and therefore they have an infinite supply of interest on loans. And that's why banks like this system very well indeed. And that's exactly what they were doing. So they were expanding the money supply, and there was the bubble, and then along comes the burst of the bubble. Well, did they do it because they wanted to help the American people? My answer is no. They did it because they wanted to expand their loans. Now, the next question that usually comes along is, well, did they plan the burst of the bubble? And there's an argument you could make that they did, because they knew that when the bubble bursts, they collect a lot of the assets. You go to the bank and you ask for, say, $100,000, $500,000 loan. Now, the bank creates the money out of nothing. They've got nothing invested in it. But they give you the money. What do they want? They want your signature on the mortgage, don't they? So if you don't pay back the loan, they get the farm, or they get your house or your tractor or whatever. And so when the bubble bursts, a lot of people lose their marbles. The banks gather in all the marbles. So it's tempting to say that the banks probably really like a bust because they collect a lot of assets at a very low price. I'm not arguing against that, but I see it a little differently. I think the banks do better without a bust. I think they're doing quite well without having to take over a house and then have to sell a house. They don't want to be in the real estate business. They really don't. They would rather be in the interest collecting business. It's a lot more lucrative, and it's a lot less trouble, a lot less risk. And so they don't want, really want a bust. But I believe they know it's coming. They know that that's part of the cost of doing business, you might say. If you're going to run a fiat system, you're going to have booms and busts. So prepare for them. Doesn't mean they're making them happen, but it does mean they're smart enough to know that they're coming. And so they try and time their own investments and their own portfolios so that when it happens, they will be among the winners rather than the losers. And I have no doubt that if they see a collapse coming, they might be tempted to pick the date and say, well, we're going to pick the date. We're going to insert the pin into the bubble on this date because we're prepared on this date. I think that's entirely possible. In a nutshell, that's my view of what happened in the Great Depression, and we're seeing a run-up to exactly the same play again today.
Unfortunately so. And for the skeptical listeners out there, it should be noted that the Federal Reserve's role in the creation of the Great Depression is not even controversial. In fact, no less a personage than Ben Bernanke himself, the current chair of the Federal Reserve, admitted that the Great Depression was caused by the Federal Reserve System at Milton Friedman's 90th birthday. He said, yes, the Federal Reserve caused the Great Depression, but we won't do it again.
Yeah, he was almost apologetic about it, wasn't he? It was kind of like, we won't do it again.
Well, it was almost said in a kind of joking manner. Oh, we won't do it again. But at any rate, as you say, we are on the cusp of a very similar catastrophic collapse caused again by the expansion, the incredible expansion of the money supply in recent years. Well, let's talk about one of the mechanisms by which this process of the banks continuing to make money, even in the face of these types of busts, actually functions. And you do a great job of outlining this in your book, which I believe was first published in 1994. I'm working with the fourth edition, which came out in 2006. So one that I believe 2006, which certainly predates the recent era of collapse, which is unfortunate because you do a great job of pointing out all of the various bailout schemes that have happened in the last few decades by which the banks continue to make money from their loans, and they continue to get paid basically on the back of the American taxpayers who foot the bill through Congress. A very interesting process, and one that's important to understand, especially in the wake of the Lehman Brothers collapse and the trillions of dollars that have been given out in bailouts since then. Let's talk about the bailout mechanism and how that plays a function in this system.
Yeah, well, first of all, James, remind me when we're through with this, I must send you a current edition of the book.
Thank you.
Yeah, we've updated it a lot since then. The fifth edition was primarily caused by the need to include this latest round of bailouts. I think that's no longer the right word. I just call them plunders. starting in 2008. Yes, and but it's a very simple concept, and it was conceived at this meeting on Jekyll Island back in 1910. This is one of the things they discussed. As we know, they didn't say it quite this openly and bluntly, but they were basically discussing the probabilities, I think is the word they use, that there might be a crisis or some kind of a stress on the system. You know, use soft words. But it was very much in their mind that the system would possibly come unraveled, and it would need it would either go out of business, it would either these guys would wind up on the scaffold, run out of town on a rail maybe, and tarred and feathered and that kind of stuff, or, and this is what their preferred mechanism, or we can bring in the government as our partner, and now we can rely on government as a means of transferring our losses or our stresses to the taxpayer. And they were smart enough to figure out that the taxpayer wouldn't go for that, and Congress wouldn't go for that, unless it could be framed in such a way that it was in the best interest of the people or the best interest of the nation. It had to be a way of helping or protecting the nation, protecting against terrible, terrible calamities. And that has always been the game they've played. Whenever the banks are in trouble, they go to their partners in Congress. Now, remember, well, they were partners. I think now they're their employees. I think that's a more honest way of describing it. I think the Congress is more the servant in this case than it used to be. Anyway, they go to Congress, to their buddies in Congress, and they say, look, we just lost $22 trillion, and we can't keep this up much longer, so we need some more money. Now, let's see, how are we going to explain this? How are the people going to buy this? Oh, I know. We're going to bail out some of the corporations that owe us money. Let's say it's General Motors, or it's who knows? It might be New York City. It might be a nation. It might be Mexico. I mean, add up all of these loans that the banks have made, trillions of dollars in loans to borrowers that they know are probably not going to be able to pay back those loans at the terms of the loan. They know that, because they can read the financial summaries as well as any high school student taking bookkeeping, you know. They know that the cash flow is not supporting the outflow, and they can see the political climate in countries like Mexico, where productivity is being bled by the government. And they know, they can see it clearly, but yet they'll make the loans anyway to a country like that, knowing full well that if the loans go sour, they have several steps they can go through to still get their money back. But at the end of those series of steps, it'll be pressing the American taxpayer into service to bail out the companies or bail out the countries, so that the countries can then continue to send the money to the banks. It's a brilliant ploy, and it has been working now for decades. And starting in 2008, the numbers had jumped astronomical. In fact, it's hard to even put numbers on them anymore. We're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars, which is just mind-boggling. When I was first learning how to use a calculator, I guess it was back in the 1950s, they had a Friedan calculator. It was a big machine, had all these buttons, and it was amazing because it could do multiplication. And go whir, chunk, 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 and you could multiply. I don't think those machines could have handled these numbers that Congress raises their hands and say, well, we'll vote for $3 trillion or $9 trillion. They'll just vote for this kind of money. And if anybody asked any of these congressmen, where is the money going to come from? They'd probably say, well, I never thought about that. It was just, I don't know, but we'll get it somehow. And the answer is, it comes from the Federal Reserve. They just create this money out of nothing. And the congressmen, their buddies, voted into existence. And so we call it a bailout, or something that sounds good, some kind of an infusion. Give it some nice word. And where does it go? Well, it may go to a few borrowers, but generally it either goes directly to the banks or indirectly to the banks. And all of a sudden you begin to understand what the word cartel means. The cartel is directing all of this, and so it should be no surprise that 99% of the benefit of all of this infusion of newly created money and plundering of the taxpayer to do so winds up in the banks, no matter what they call it. And so, and then I don't know if that really answers the question or not, but that's where my mind went with all of this. You start off with the theory. You start off with the origin of the Federal Reserve as a cartel back in 1913. You see it evolving, and all of a sudden you're living in today's world where all of this huge river of money is going out of the taxpayers' pockets, out of the middle class, and into the government, and then into the banks, and it all winds up in the banks. There's a transfer of wealth going on that history has never seen before. The middle class is being squeezed and squeezed by all of this. And it's not that it's the upper class or the wealthy getting wealthier. Let's call it what it is. It's the politically favored class. That is the upper class. It's not just these fat capitalists. The ones with the most money today are not capitalists at all. They're collectivists. They're socialists. They're communists. They're dictators. They know that you don't make big money today by free enterprise competition, by providing a better service or a better product at the lowest cost. They know that. You make the most money today by going to Washington and buying up a few congressmen and senators and get them to pass laws that give you monopoly privileges in the marketplace. That's how it's done today. So I don't know if that really covers the question, but that's where my mind went in answer to it.
I think it is a very, very good answer because it does go to the heart of the issue. These people are, of course, monopolists. And what Yes. greater monopoly could possibly exist than monopoly over the money supply itself, which is the That's very it. Foundation of the economy? It truly is staggering once you really start to realize the extent of the crime. That doesn't even seem like an appropriate word. It doesn't seem to do justice to the scale of what's happened over the past 100 years. But let's turn to one of the underlying memes that has been spread in recent years to try to describe this bailout process, which is too big to fail, which is the underlying justification for why the American taxpayer has to be on the hook for the excesses of the banking system and all of their failures. Well, we can't allow these banks to fail because they're just too big. It would take down the entire economy with it, which, again, as you note in your book, is the common theme that is constantly used to try to justify these bailouts. Right. And unfortunately, we've had added in recent years the idea of too big to jail, and perhaps no greater indication of who is really running the country can be found than Attorney General Eric Holder's recent remarks that there are some U.S. banks that are literally too big to prosecute because the idea of attempting to prosecute the criminality of some of these banks might itself threaten the economic system in a way that the U.S. government apparently doesn't want to do. I think this is perhaps the greatest indicator of who is really running the country, but it does raise the question, once you have that type of monopoly power, what is the next step? Are they content to simply use this power as they have been wielding it up till this point? Or is there an end goal that they're still striving towards in all of this?
Well, James, I think there is another goal, and I've been aware of that from the very beginning. When you go back to the beginning of all of this, if you go back prior to the Federal Reserve, it's pretty clear to me, at least, that the name of the game was financial power and wealth. That was it. How do you make more money? How do you beat out your competition? How do you forge partnerships with politicians that give you privileges and advantages that give you more power so you can buy more politicians and so forth? That was pretty much the game. But starting with the era of the Federal Reserve, starting at the turn of the last century, there was a new element that began to creep into it, and it was kind of epitomized by J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan was, I think by any measure or any definition of the word, you could call him one of the founders of the Council on Foreign Relations in America. He was certainly not the top man, but in America, he was the most influential person in getting it established. The Council on Foreign Relations is merely a branch of a larger international group that was originated in England and created by Cecil Rhodes. Its sister organizations are the Royal Institute for International Affairs. You find that in London and in Australia and New Zealand and all of the former British dependencies. And in America, they created one too, but they didn't call it the Royal Institute for International Affairs because Americans didn't respond very well to the word royal. So they changed it to the Council on Foreign Relations. And J.P. Morgan was the one that was very instrumental, most instrumental, in getting that embedded into the American political and economic system. Well, why mention that? Because if you understand what this Royal Institute of International Affairs is, / Council on Foreign Relations, and what its goals are, it's stunning because the whole purpose of this group is to denationalize every nation, to destroy the nationhood of every country, to merge all nations into what they like to call the New World Order. It's their phrase for it, which is nothing more than a way of describing a world government based on the model of collectivism. Now, the model of collectivism needs a little definition. It's just another way of saying all-powerful government with the people at the bottom serving the government, with its leaders at the top, just the flip over reverse of what America used to be, where the government was considered to be the servant of the people. The people were in charge, theoretically at least, and the government had to respond to their will. Now, under collectivism, it's the other way around. The government is in charge, and the people have to take orders in the name of the people. That's one of the tricks they use. It's always in the name of serving society or the greater good of the greater number. It's kind of a brain game that they've played. But nevertheless, the reality is that under collectivism, governments are all powerful, and people are primarily there to serve the state. And they have been told that that's the best way for them to serve their own interests as well. So this Council on Foreign Relations, under the foundation of J.P. Morgan, has become the most, in my view, the most powerful organization in America. It's not very big. It has a little over 4,000 members. But if you look at the list of members, and it's published, you can see it on the internet. Those aren't just your average guys. I mean, they're the heads of the giant corporations, the media outlets. They're presidents of the United States, secretaries of state, secretaries of the Treasury, senators, congressmen. They are literally the rulers of America in the sense that they determine public policy. And so I'm wandering a little bit. I think that with the institution of the Council on Foreign Relations back, and this was started about 1910, suddenly the motivation for these people was amplified a bit. Yes, they still wanted to make money. They still wanted to have monopolistic control over the economy. They wanted to control the money supply so they could determine who gets credit and who doesn't. And so they could have access to an infinite supply themselves. But now they're beginning to think about world power. After a person has all the money in the world that you could possibly use to buy anything you want, what's left to capture your imagination? And the answer, of course, is power. Power over people. Now, money is power over people, but there's another power over people as well, and that is the political power, the social power. And I think this has now become the dominant driving force of these people. They've already got the money. They've got it locked down. Now they're striving for this new world order, as their name for it. They want all of the world and into one political unit, which they dominate, not only with money, but with military and psychological means and education and media and propaganda. They want total control over every human on the planet. And by golly, they're moving pretty rapidly in that direction.
Absolutely. Well, it is, again, a mind-boggling process. And I think just the connections and foundations of the banking establishment in America and its roots in founding the Council on Foreign Relations is a fascinating topic and entire history unto itself. But I realize we are running out of time for this conversation. So let's wrap up with just two final questions. The first being that in your book, again, you lay out, and for people who are intimidated by the size of this rather hefty volume, it truly is a very reader-friendly book. You provide chapter summaries and very easy access for people to kind of find a way into the thread of this somewhat overwhelming topic. So I will once again recommend that people get it. And you also have a very nice, concise list of reasons to abolish the Federal Reserve. Perhaps we can go over just a summary of what are the main reasons why we should be working towards the abolition of this system.
Well, I'd almost have to have my list in front of me, but it took a lot of time to condense these complex ideas into very short statements. And Well, I think usury was certainly one of the reasons, wasn't it? It was the instrument of usury, because the Federal Reserve is the engine of inflation. Inflation is a tax. Probably the most unfair tax of all. It hits the people with lowest incomes the hardest. The very wealthy people don't care about inflation because their income is always expanding faster than inflation anyway. They're always at the point where the new money comes into society, so they got plenty of this new money, and they're always ahead of everybody else. So inflation is a tax. It's an unfair tax. When you figure out how much money you spend for borrowed capital, when you count inflation, at the end of a lifetime, at the end of 70 years or so, you've paid 93 to 97% of everything you've earned and saved. You could argue that 7% or 12% was pretty high, but 97% I would call usury by any man's definition. People don't realize that. Another reason, of course, is that without this money mechanism, most of the modern wars we've seen today would never be fought. I think if people knew how much this war on terrorism, so-called, is costing them, and how much this war on drugs is costing them, if they had to every year write a check to the government and pay their share of that cost, there would be a tax rebellion of the highest magnitude in the morning, you know? But since they don't have to write the check, since the money is taken from them sneakily and quietly and in a way that they don't even understand through inflation, they tolerate it. And so most of these wars would never be fought if people had to pay for them. People aren't willing to pay huge amounts of money for wars unless they're really defensive wars, unless they're really protecting their own country and their own families. None of this business about making the world safe for democracy, it's not going to go, you know. Most of that is just propaganda anyway for some other hidden agenda. So it's those kinds of things, James. Maybe you've got the list in front of you, but it's
actually I do, and maybe we should just read it into the record for the posterity. The reasons are it is incapable of accomplishing its stated objectives. Yeah. It is a cartel operating against the public interest. It is the supreme instrument of usury. It generates our most unfair tax, the inflation tax, which you talked about. It encourages war. It destabilizes the economy, and it is an instrument of totalitarianism. And I believe we have at least touched on all of those points. Yeah. And again, they are elaborated at great length in this book. So once again, we will direct people there. So finally, I would like to close this conversation on something, I hope, of a positive note. And that is to say that at the time that you wrote this book in 1994, I imagine it would have been almost unthinkable that just a couple of decades later, we would be here at a point in time where not only does a growing proportion of the American public know about the Federal Reserve System and why it does deserve to be abolished, but that there is a growing political movement gathering around that idea. And I don't know about yourself, but when I see crowds of thousands of people attending Campaign for Liberty events, for example, chanting, "End the Fed," that to me strikes me as something that is truly revolutionary in a deeper sense than I think a lot of the revolutions which we are which are dangled before us. This is something that really goes towards striking at the root of this system, and at the very fact that so many people are now motivated, energized, and informed about the Federal Reserve and abolishing that system, to me, strikes me as something hopeful, as something positive. Perhaps you can speak to that idea and the fact that we are moving into this time where more people are aware of the problem and what to do about it.
Well, James, you've summarized it very well. I don't know that I could say it any better than that, except to agree with you. It's very encouraging, and certainly it's true that back in 1994, when I released this thing, I thought, you know, I hope this make some effect somewhere down the line in history, but probably not going to happen. I'll ever see any of it. And to my amazement, I am seeing it. And the thing that encourages me too, James, about that is that the type of people, the quality of the people, and the age of the people who are in this movement. It's not the old fuddy-duddies like me. It's not the old folks. You know, when I came into this back in the 1960s, I was just a young guy. I'd look around and look like all the patriots, anybody that was really concerned, there were a bunch of old people. I thought, well, where are all the young guys, you know? Well, now I'm looking around, and of course, I'm one of the old guys, but I'm looking around, and everybody now who's concerned seems to be young. This is a big change, and it bodes very well for the future. These are the people who will make a difference. They're the leaders. The leaders coming up not only tomorrow, but today.
Well, that's right. And the leaders of tomorrow and of today are out there, and they are increasingly concerned about this issue. And it is largely due to the work of people like yourself who have been raising this alarm for so long, for decades now. And it really is on the back of that type of work that we can proceed forward on this in this task of abolishing the Federal Reserve. And if it was unthinkable that so many people would be aware of and motivated by this task a couple of decades ago, then perhaps we can hope that in a couple of decades there will be a similar movement to truly to abolish this and to make sure that it does not rear its ugly head again. This den of vipers that has been cast out before and can be cast out again, and hopefully this is not a futile quest. Unfortunately, I think our time is at a close for today, but G. Edward Griffin, I just want to thank you once again, not only for your time today, but I think for your time and service over the decades raising the alarm on this important task and directing people once again to support this work and to purchase The Creature from Jekyll Island, preferably the latest edition, including all the latest on the more recent crimes that have come about as the result of this system. So once again, thank you very much for all of your work, G. Edward Griffin. It really is a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you, James. Thanks for inviting me, and keep up the great work you're doing.